The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
So we did notice events or the absolute risks for any of those, whether it's a composite outcome or individually, between 1% to 2%.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine, in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call features an article titled Comparative Gastrointestinal Safety of Dulaglutide, Semaglutide, and Tirzepatide in Adults with Type 2 Diabetes. Joining us is one of the authors of the paper, Waj Alkabani, who is a pharmacoepidemiologist at University of Waterloo School of Pharmacy. I think that you'll find this interesting and useful in your practice. Well, Waj, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. This article that you and your colleagues wrote really, I think, is very important because we're using so many GLP-1s in the United States, and I assume that's also starting to be true in Canada, where you are. And understanding that the severe adverse effects, I think, is very important. Now, we're not going to be able to cover the routine adverse effects that many of my friends have had, because I certainly have several friends who've been on GLP-1s, which makes me normal. But why don't you start out with what was the rationale for why you and your colleagues want to do this study?
Like you mentioned, the utilization trends have been going up tremendously. Now, for semaglutide and dulaglutide, I will be using generic names today, but for those two medications, we've had them for about 15 years now as diabetes medications, cornerstone in practice, relatively well tolerated. But then when the obesity indication came in for semaglutide a few years ago, followed by the introduction of the dual agonist, that is tirzepatide, the uptake has been tremendous. In fact, our group has another paper in Annals a few months ago, maybe a year ago, that looked at the uptake in the United States for these medications. And you can see that trend spiking after the introduction of tirzepatide. We've just had the holidays a few days ago. It's a topic of interest for the public. A lot of patients are using it. They're worried about gastrointestinal side effects. That's in terms of, you know, the public interest, why we need the rationale for the study. But from a methodology point of view, I do want to talk about why we decided to do this target trial emulation, for example. We all know that RCTs are, you know, there's a good argument that they are the best source of evidence. The reason why we do RCTs in the world of diabetes is to make sure we're capturing their effect on glycemic management as well as their cardiovascular safety. But RCTs are not necessarily powered to capture a rare adverse event like gastroparesis. So we kind of need that real world evidence. And I think this is where observational pharmacoepi studies shine in case of a rare safety event. Like the ones we're interested in. Also, there's an argument for RCTs having very controlled setting, not really representative of that real world evidence or practice. It excludes a lot of patients and so on. So I think these two, the interest of the public, the gaps in research, the fact that the trials are not powered enough, all of this together was important to be a rationale for the study.
So let's make sure that we all understand the severe adverse effects that you were able to look at. So these are things that we have many primary care physicians and hospitalists who listen to this. And I want to make sure we all understand what we're most worried about.
So There's a couple of reasons to why we did this. Like you said, there's an interest, but also it's important to acknowledge what kind of data we were using and what can we actually capture with that data. So our study, for example, and I know we'll talk about methodology later, but it's important to mention that our study is using data from Optum Data Mart, which is insurance claims data. So capturing something like a, I don't want to minimize it by saying a mild nausea or vomiting, but we want to make sure we are actually able to capture that outcome properly. So we decided to look at severe adverse events because when a patient goes to the hospital and they are admitted to the hospital, we'll be able to capture that with certainty because they will be admitted. There will be an ICD-10 administered to the system. However, if a patient has mild constipation or diarrhea and they give their pharmacist a call, I won't be able to see that in my data. So there will be a huge underestimation of the outcomes. So that's one of the reasons it's related to the data. But like I said, also the public's interest because they are worried about. You know, I've been hearing a lot of patients saying, oh, my cousin, my friend went to the hospital and she's been hospitalized for 3 days because she had severe GI side events. So again, both of those methodology related and public interest as
Yeah,
well.
but what are the particular ones that when we get down to the results, what are the particular GI adverse effects that you were able to capture?
Yeah, we were interested, or we captured, I guess, five. So we had a primary composite outcome, and then we looked at five individual outcomes, and those would be gastrointestinal motility related outcomes like gastroparesis. I know the public has been very concerned, especially the mainstream media, about that. Severe constipation, bowel obstruction or intestinal obstruction, as well as biliary events and acute pancreatitis, because those have been areas of interest and discussion as well.
Great. We've discussed propensity matching several times on this podcast, but I was really glad to see that you did this. And what's interesting about the propensity matching is, and it's time for us to get a little bit into methodology, we have three different medications, and you did pairwise comparisons of each of those three. So there's three different pairwise comparisons. And the numbers are different because there are more people taking. I think semaglutide has the most probably right now, although tirzepatide is really gaining as fast as you can imagine. But maybe you could talk just a little bit about the implications of of propensity matching and why it was the right thing to do for this, and then we'll get on to trying to get to some results.
Yeah, I'm gonna just take a step back and very quickly and explain what propensity score, in case there's a listener who does, is not familiar with it. So a propensity score is simply the person's probability or conditional probability of receiving treatment given a set of characteristics. And usually a propensity score by modeling the exposure or the treatment allows me to include a wide set of important covariates or characteristics, including the demographics, their medical conditions, what medications they're on, their healthcare utilization patterns, and so on. So it's a very beneficial and a very good way to model the exposure and the outcome separately. Once you calculate that propensity score, you can use it in different ways. One way is that matching method. And this, and you can, there's various ways to do the matching. We decided to go with sometimes simpler is better, one-to-one propensity score matching, because we did have enough numbers to allow us to do so. So in terms of the pairwise, you could do a three-way comparison if you want. So you can do one target trial emulation where you're looking at dulaglutide versus semaglutide versus tirzepatide. That comes at, you have to have some, there are some biostatistical considerations when you do something like this, because those numbers will get to be lower because we're looking at an overlap of patient characteristics that are a clinical equipoise that would be across the three medications. And to find that overlap across three medications, specifically given how dulaglutide and tirzepatide are slightly different in terms of indications, that could affect my sample size. Also, there was an interest in from our clinicians to look at these drugs separately in pairwise comparisons. Like you said, most of the interest, to be perfectly honest, was tirzepatide versus semaglutide. I do think in terms dulaglutide has potentially is taking the backseat more recently. And that explains also the numbers you've mentioned. We had our biggest cohort, I believe, was the semaglutide dulaglutide. And that's simply in virtue because of we had a longer time period, just because they existed for a longer period. The second biggest cohort was tirzepatide versus semaglutide. And I think that's where a lot of the interest wise. I can talk a little bit more about matching in terms of technicalities, but I don't want to bore the listeners with
Now
that.
Let's figure out who the patients were. I always love table one. Table one in most studies, are these the patients I'm taking care of? So why don't you give us a rough explanation of who's in this study?
I'm going to talk about the three pairwise comparisons in general, but the patients can see that there are minor differences if you look at each of the pairwise comparisons. So the mean age of the patients was about 61 to 62, so relatively slightly older cohort, I want to say. The sex distributions was relatively fair, about I think 50%, 49 to 50% females. So that I would say generally representative sex-wise. There are some things that are believe are interested in table interesting in table ones is remember this cohort study for those who potentially didn't get a chance to read it is restricted to patients with type 2 diabetes. And there was reasons why we had to do that and not include patients with obesity who don't have type 2 diabetes to ensure the internal validity of the study. But you'll clearly see that, for example, there was the BMI was higher for patients who are taking tirzepatide versus their matches who are taking dulaglutide. And I think that makes sense in practice, right? Because tirzepatide has that obesity indication, while dulaglutide is not necessarily used for that obesity indication, even in patients who have type 2 diabetes. Alternatively, you'll see that patients on dulaglutide compared to the tirzepatide, for example, have more of those diabetes-related complications, like diabetes-related neuropathy, nephropathy, and so on. So that gives you an idea that there was some, before adjustment, of course, before propensity score adjustment, there was an imbalance in the nature of the cohort with dulaglutide and semaglutide being more of a diabetes cohort, while tirzepatide being more resembling an obesity cohort, although everybody had type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, so the tirzepatide are obese people with type 2 diabetes, not just plain obesity without type 2 diabetes. And I think that's an important, you and your colleagues make that very clear in the conclusion that we're not 100% sure that we can use this to understand pure obesity, although I think we probably can. Why don't you talk about the major results?
So I think the biggest takeaway from this paper, if I want to summarize it in a 1 minute sentence, would be that we didn't really see a differential risk in terms of GI severe GI events between the three GLP-1 based therapies. So there's been a lot of, I heard some people tell me as a pharmacist or to their physician, "Oh, I feel like I'm not getting a lot of GI events where I'm on tirzepatide versus dulaglutide." So when we actually did this head to head, no, actually the risk was similar across the three groups, and we didn't see a higher risk with tirzepatide, for example, compared to dulaglutide. There's some hypotheses that maybe tirzepatide is a dual agonist, therefore it would be more potent. But no, we didn't really capture that. But I don't want this to affect what we already know in terms of GLP-1 as a class. So for GLP-1 as a class compared to another class of diabetes drugs like SGLT2 inhibitors, we did some work to show that there's actually an increased risk of these GI events, severe GI events. I just want to make it clear that when you compare the three GLP-1 medications to each other, we didn't necessarily see that one is worse than the other one. So that would be the umbrella result. I should say we've done a ton of subgroup and sensitivity analysis. All of our sensitivity analysis showed a robust finding of that conclusion. And that conclusion did not differ across subgroups of by age, sex, BMI, frailty, and a series of other subgroup analyses.
As someone who loves to carefully look at subgroup analyses, I was very impressed. I was very impressed. Could you talk a little bit about how common these severe adverse effects occurred? Because I think that number is an important number for us to all know, and most of us don't know that number.
Yeah, so exactly. We always focus on the relative risk, but I think the absolute, there's a room for the absolute risk that's very important. So we did notice events or the absolute risks for any of those, whether it's a composite outcome or individually, between 1 to 2%. So, talking to clinicians, I'm not a physician, I'm a pharmacist by training, but talking to physicians, you'll get someone to say, actually, 1%, I'm not too worried. That doesn't seem too high to me. I'm okay with that. But in my mind, that's an individual physician-patient conversation. A lot of patients might not want to take that 1%. They think it's too high potentially. So I think providing those absolute risks helps that conversation between physicians and patients about their level of comfort, and they'll weigh their, risk benefit and decide if it's something they would like to initiate. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really important if you're going to do shared decision making with patients to have a number to go back at and say 1 in 100 or 1 to 2 in 100 might have one of these five adverse effects that we can take care of, but will mean that you probably won't be able to take it again. Although
Exactly.
I'm not aware of anybody who's taken a GLP-1 after one of these adverse effects. You may know that literature better than me.
There's a small percentage. This is one of the reasons why our cohort, for example, was patients without a history of major GI events. We wanted to make that clear. Honestly, we've been talking, media has been reaching out to us and asking if we were looking into patients with major a history of major GI events. We haven't done that yet. I don't know if we'll have the numbers to do it, but I believe some patients are receiving it because they, despite the history of GI events, they kind of outweigh the benefits of weight loss. And to them, that's potentially more important and sometimes worth the risk. I don't know the numbers off of the back of my hand, but I assume those people exist.
Yeah, no, I'm sure there's some people exist. I was wondering if you've had an adverse effect, are you more likely to have another adverse effect?
Yeah,
Usually that's true in medicine, but if we don't have data, we don't have data.
that's definitely worth doing it.
I know that it would be impossible in this study, but I think it's important for us to point out that you don't have data on the less severe, the non-hospitalization outcomes. And I certainly have friends who've had a lot of diarrhea, people who get constipation, but don't, it's not so bad that they have to go to the hospital. And I'm sure that some of the media that have been reaching out to you have been asking questions about that, which obviously, the way you did the study, there's no way to answer that question.
Yeah, that's brings me back to my original point when we started the conversation is we would have loved to. I don't think it would be done properly because there will be an underestimation of those outcomes. They will not be well captured given the database that we used. I think this is room for future work in terms of the importance of survey, self-reporting, electronic health records data, kind of, I want to say, more granular and rich databases, although it might be a smaller sample size, but I think there's room for something like that. And not to say that those are tolerable, right? We also want to look at discontinuation rates because for a lot of patients, what we call mild diarrhea might not be a tolerable thing for them, right? Although
Absolutely.
it didn't lead to hospital admission, but they wanted to continue the medication.
Yeah. It's now this is a very important study, and this is a study you're going to have to redo after they come out with the oral agents and after they come out with the triple. So tirzepatide is a double. Now we're going to have a triple come out. You're not going to run out of work in this field anytime soon. I've said this on many podcasts already. One of the things I'm most concerned about is the longer term impact of being on GLP-1s, because most patients who go on a GLP-1 remain on the GLP-1 indefinitely because they're so happy about this is about weight loss and all the indications for weight loss. It's very hard to continue to have that weight loss when you've stopped. Any final thoughts from you about the real big benefit from this study, which I think is really a great study?
I think the great benefit is for patients or physicians who are weighing their options in terms of which GLP-1 they would like to go with. At least in terms of GI events, we showed that it doesn't really matter as much as they do. Now, I know in terms matters in terms of cost and insurance and
Sure.
patients' comfort and potentially other events, but in terms of GI events, I think our study helped. I think there's room for more work in terms of dose. We weren't able to look at dose, but I think that's an important consideration. Is this a dose effect? Are we expecting more potentially GI effects with the higher doses? And like you mentioned, there's going to be a ton of work with all of these new agents entering the market. I know Canada doesn't have tirzepatide yet, but that's coming. So we're embracing ourselves.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. This very interesting study starts out by proving thus far that when you're considering severe adverse effects of GLP-1s, there does not seem to be a difference amongst the three drugs that were studied, and it should not be a basis for making a decision amongst those three. Now, the cautions of this study is it only looked at severe adverse effects, and we all have seen many non-severe adverse effects. There's no data on discontinuation of GLP-1s because while the effects are not severe, they're bothersome. It also gives us a very good number to tell patients when we start a GLP-1 that there's about a 1% to 2% chance, regardless of the GLP-1, that they will have a severe adverse effect. This will have an impact in our conversations with patients about GLP-1s. We hope that this podcast is useful for you in your practice, and thank you so much for listening to our podcast.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall